My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic.
Mike.
If any of you were ever wondering what a deer in the headlights looks like, this is it. I want to thank the committee, Nancy, and my guest Steve, or my the people that are showing me around, Steve and Kay. This has absolutely been wonderful. The Gopher State Roundup is everything that I heard it was, as I had some previous attendees give me some information. My sobriety date is December 28, 1985. My home group is the Fairhaven, Vermont group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Vermont, born in Vermont. Born in Vermont. Born in Vermont. All similarities end there. This is the Saturday morning cartoon show. I don't know about the rest of you, and I'll probably embarrass myself because I'm part of the TV generation. I was brought up in front of the television, and I relate a lot to some of the things that went on in those days. In my home group, my current service position is that of bleeding deacon. As they said, I recently was voted off the island as Northeast Regional Trustee. And this Friday in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, they will try to surgically remove the gavel from my hand. So that could be an interesting show. So I pass the gavel, and then it's off back to the home group, and they're probably caucusing as we speak to decide exactly whether or not that they'll keep me around. But if any of you'd like to attend, we have three meetings a week. On Monday, we have a 12 and 12 meeting and a speaker meeting at the end of the month. On Thursday, we have a big book step study meeting. And on Friday, we have an open discussion meeting. All of you would be welcome. If you all show up at the same time, don't worry about not having a chair to sit in. Somebody's going to say something to tick somebody off, and chairs will be opening up all over the place because that's the usual order of business in that group. So I was born in Vermont. I started out as a child. I had two older brothers, David and Ricky, and two younger brothers, Wally and Beav. But at least that's how I saw them. But see, I didn't fit in. I didn't fit into either the Cleaver family or the Nelson family. I just didn't fit in there. And my brothers, of course, being the kind souls that they were, had me convinced that I was adopted. I believed it. I actually had my parents convinced of it on several occasions, but my mother swore, she used to get real angry at that one. You weren't adopted. I don't want you going around telling people that anymore. So I had my first drink when I was about 12 years old. It was a warm beer, half a warm beer in the old tent in the backyard. My brother had smuggled it out of the refrigerator and kept it hidden for several days to see if anyone would miss it. You know, if someone had missed it, then it would magically appear back in there. So what do you mean there's one missing? Look, count them. But he was good at that sort of thing. So we shared the beer in the back, and it did nothing. Well, okay, this is wonderful. It tastes warm. It's not, you know, I'd rather have a soda. It's no big deal. The effect of alcohol wasn't there yet. So when I got a little older, we used to have mother gone away parties. My parents would go away for a weekend or a couple of days in the summertime, and you know, my older brothers would be rubbing their hands waiting in anticipation and I never got to drinking up at those either because I was the youngest of my two older brothers would imbibe heavily and get sick and throw up all over, and they'd expect Junior to clean it up. Nothing, still. No fun at all. Later on, I did the youthful experimentation thing. As I got into high school and college, I played sports, so you weren't supposed to drink. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like I was giving up anything. So I found the effect of alcohol later than some. I was in my late teens, and I began the youthful experimentation thing. And when I first experienced the effect of alcohol, I knew what I had arrived meant. Because I had arrived, and I wanted the effect that magic elixir created in me. It solved all my problems. I wasn't adopted anymore. I could fit in. I was on my way. The problem was, of course, almost immediately upon finding the effect of alcohol, I got married, moved in with the in-laws, and started to proceed on my drinking career. there's only a couple of things missing. One was I didn't have any money, and two, I had a wife who frowned on that sort of thing. I was lucky. I met and married the love of my life. The problem was it took me a long time to find that out. It took Alcoholics Anonymous to show me that, because I was one of those people who I didn't fit in, I didn't feel right, I couldn't make a commitment because if I told someone I loved them, they're going to let me down. And then I couldn't stand the pain of that, so I would say whatever I needed to say to get whatever I needed, and I missed out a lot on life. And so I thank God today for what you people have done for me, because it gave me all those things that I would have missed had I not found you. So I proceeded to proceed in my drinking career. I went and became a teacher. There, that didn't solve the money problems. So, and I drank whenever I could. Bowling night was always a good excuse to drink. I don't know how I could get as drunk as I did every bowling night on the money that the wife would dole out. She'd say, "You're going bowling? Here. You know, give me $5 or something," and say, "Have a good time." You know, so I would call in all my favors. I would, do something to get free drinks. But it worked every week. So I got part-time jobs. I worked in bars. I worked at, had a great job at a summer camp. I ran this summer camp for a few years. I mean, I was a basketball coach, so I thought my kids only had pajamas to wear because I saw them in the morning when I left for school, and then I saw them when I came home late at night from games, practice, or whatever, and they're always in pajamas, so I didn't know they had any clothes. So I proceeded to this summer camp thing was the best thing that ever happened to me. Here it was a job, and it was in my field, and I had to stay there pretty much all week so I could go home after I put the little campers to bed and say goodnight to the wife and stop on the bar on the way home. And I got to drink in almost every day. I really had arrived, and I just started to go downhill from there. I started to notice something was wrong with me. There had always been something wrong, and booze had always fixed it, but it stopped working. It started to stop working long before I started to stop drinking, and I'll tell you that. So I just continued to drink until I couldn't drink anymore, I guess. But I can remember taking the cure. One of them was I read the book Hypno-Cybernetics, where you hypnotize yourself into proper behavior. The amount of time I spent sitting in that chair all alone in that room trying to hypnotize myself, thinking about where my next drink was coming from, was an awful waste. So if I put this much effort in trying to find this program as I did trying to fix myself, I'd have got here a long time before that. I lost both those jobs. I got fired as the basketball coach because of my behavior. I got fired as so I'll make amends to anyone who was a basketball referee from the late 70s and early 80s. Thank God this is Minnesota. I doubt I've crossed paths with any of you because the rest of them, they aren't ready for the amends yet. But and then the summer camp job, that was a close call because I saw the guy coming up the walk and I kind of knew what he wanted to talk about. So I resigned immediately when he walked through the door so that he didn't have the right to fire me. So we came to a mutual agreement on our parting of the ways, but and I was crushed and destroyed. You know, here I was, and this friend of mine stepped right up, and I got a great job. Maitre d' in a country western bar. That's one of the moxymorons. It doesn't make any sense. But it was fun for a while. It had the benefit I was looking for. It cut down on my bar bill. Because A, I was making money I could spend somewhere else, and B, I could drink for free there. So, but I didn't like the threat. When you're the maitre d', see, at the end of the night you become the bouncer, and if someone's given trouble, you got to throw them out, and there's a danger you could get hurt or whatever. So I became the bartender, which was my natural skill, I believe. But that was only because, well, they didn't make much money on me, I don't think. But so that's where I was running, and I was working, every spare minute I had. The wife and kids, well, they were all tucked away safely in their lives, and I thought I was doing a heck of a job as a dad and a husband and getting drunk every day, and I couldn't figure out why I felt the way I did. And every day I'd get up and say, I'm not going to drink anymore. And every afternoon about 3 o'clock I'd say, I'll stop. up for just one because I need something to take the edge off. And I'd have one and then another and then another and wonder at 1 o'clock in the morning why everyone else was leaving. We were just starting to have a good time. I used to stop at the, on the way home, went by this bar one night. I remember very clearly, I looked in the parking lot, snowing like mad, a foot of snow on the ground. There's one car, there are two cars in the parking lot. One of them had been there for like 6 months because somebody couldn't get it to start, and the other one belonged to the bartender who was just waiting, watching the minutes go away. So I stopped in because I knew that people were going to arrive so that we could have a good time. And I've only been asked to leave on several occasions, and that was one of them, but I wanted to drink more than I wanted to do anything else in the world. I reached my bottom, a bottom, when the wife had found out that, you know, maybe I wasn't behaving the way I should be behaving. And she called me on that and threatened me with lots of interesting ways in which I could make amends, I guess. One of them was to die. She convinced me that I needed to do something. Now, strange series of events, all sorts of weird behavior and stuff, and she says, I want to go to see the priest. You know, we're having this big fight and all these people and fists are flying and guns are being waved around. The cops come and they say, okay, you leave. So, yeah, right away. So we get in the car and she says, take me to the priest. So I go to the priest. We sit down in front of the priest and she's giving him her tale of woe, which it was a good one. And I'm sitting across from the priest and he says to me, Mike, do you think you might have a drinking problem? Bingo, the light went on. I mean, it was automatic. I mean, I could see the wheels started to turn, and it was like, waking, all spiritual awakening. Here's the excuse I'll use to get out of this one. So I said, yes, of course I have a drinking problem. Why do you think I behave the way I do? He says, well, that's good. Now, he said, do you think you need some help? Would you like to Alcoholics Anonymous or something, or do you need some help? No, thanks. Now that I know what the problem is, I can solve it on my own. That's no big deal. See, as long as I didn't have to talk to anyone else, I could make up my own definitions for everything, and that was the secret to life. I could say, oh, yes, I have a drinking problem, and now that I know what it is, I'll learn how to drink normally, and that was my plan. I can remember saying to the wife after 3 or 4 days of threats, won't it be nice, dear, now that I've stopped drinking, and our next wedding anniversary, we can sit down together and enjoy a bottle of wine without all this stress? Because that wasn't drinking, you see. It was a celebration thing, so I had no clue. So I tried to quit drinking on my own. If any of you have ever tried that experiment, I don't recommend it. I've done it twice, once on my own and once when I first came to AA, and both were some of the most painful and horrendous experiences of my life, and I didn't know why. I know now today that I'm an alcoholic and I suffer from a disease, and I know that if I don't have my medicine, I need some alternate form of medicine like you offered, or I'm going to be very, very uncomfortable. They describe it as restless, irritable, and discontented. And I was restless, irritable, and discontented from the second I woke up until long after I went to sleep and didn't know why. So I was having a little problem keeping my promise of not drinking. If I got away for a few minutes, I went away to summer school and, of course, tried the old experiment again and failed miserably. And when I went back to school, I was looking for an excuse to, so I made up a Friday afternoon, everyone from school is going to go to work and we're all going to celebrate the new guy in the department and have a few drinks. And the new guy said, I don't care, I'm not showing up. I said, I don't care if you show up or not, we're going to have drinks. So I wasn't, about this time I got the letter that changed my life. I had gotten one a year before. I had met this guy, and he was important in my life and in my story because I had 3 or 4 of these types of people. You probably wouldn't identify them. They're the people who drink just a little bit more than you do and are just a little bit worse, so that when someone points out you're drinking, you can say, oh, no, I'm not that bad. When I get that bad, then I'll do something about it. Well, this was one of those guys. He shows up at my school, and he's wacko, and he drank worse than I did. So I get a Christmas card 1 year, and it says, I've stopped drinking. I went to a therapist, and drinking is a problem, and I'm going to AA. We rolled on the floor laughing at that because this man was also the biggest liar I'd ever met, and he used to love to make up stories. We went to a college fraternity party one night, and he, because they had free beer, for no other reason. And he had a small notebook. He took a complete notebook of notes. So on the way out, I said to him, "What'd you write down?" He said, "Well," he said, "I've been doing some research on the Vietnam War, and I wanted to see the impact of the Vietnam War on these young college people's lives. So I was asking them questions about the Vietnam War. I looked at the notebook, and you couldn't read a letter. You couldn't, none, the words, there wasn't, they were just scribbling, hen scratching." And I'd say, "How can you read that?" He says, "I can't read it now, but," he says, "I'll get drunk again tomorrow, and then I'll be able to read it." This was my kind of guy. So he sends me this Christmas card. So the next year I send him a Christmas card and say, "Hi, I've stopped drinking. I'm doing very good. I've only had two or three since I stopped drinking." See, the definition of stop drinking didn't mean the same thing to me as it did to you. So, but it didn't count because I'm the one that's calling the shots. So he shows up at my house. And he did the one thing. It was right after Christmas. It must have been December 29th, 1985, as a matter of fact. He shows up and he says, "You wouldn't dare go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, would you?" Now, I don't know, I guess I just have selective hearing, as my wife will attest to. I don't think I'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before. Maybe in passing somewhere, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't make any sense to me, but you know, no one's ever dared me to do anything I didn't try once, so I said, "Sure, why not, let's go." So off we go. It was a 5:30 meeting in Rutland, Vermont, and I walked into this room and knew I was in the wrong place. Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't have a bar set up. I figured, you know, at least they'd serve a few drinks in the back to us poor new guys, you know, teach us how to drink respectively or responsibly or whatever. They had instant coffee, which is not one of my favorites, and they had vanilla cookies, and they know I like chocolate. So there was going to be trouble right away, but those people greeted me and they were nice to me, and something happened in that room that day, because when those people talked about themselves, I identified. It was the first time in my life that the stuff that I had felt inside began to have a name. All the little feelings that I had that had dragged me down from the time I was 10 years old, now I knew. And there are other people who felt exactly the same way I did, and I wanted what they had. And I got my big book that night. Some guy walked over and said, "This is the big book. Here, take this home, read it." I said, "Okay." So I leave the meeting, and of course I'm like the puppy dog in the car, bouncing back and forth. He's trying to drive home, and we're going, and I'm bouncing, "Oh, this is really, really wonderful. This is exactly what I've been trying to do with my life. I think I've already worked about half the steps already. You know, mind you, I've done 1, 2, 4, 7, and 8. And I'm going along like Whippoorwill's butt in a windstorm, running my mouth, and he's very calm and driving the car, and finally he turns to me and says, "Well, I got to ask you a couple questions." I said, "Okay, go ahead." He said, "The first one is, do you want to quit drinking?" I said, "Of course I want to quit drinking. Don't you realize that now? Don't you see what I've been doing all these months?" He said, "No, do you really want to quit drinking?" And I said, "Yes." I was probably lying. And he said, "Okay, the second question is, are you willing to go to any lengths?" I said, "I'm riding with you. I just been to a meeting of AA. If that's not willing to go to any lengths, I don't know what is, but..." I'll answer yes to that one too. I might have been lying. Then he asked the third question, "Do you think you can do it on your own?" And I lied. I said, "Oh no, no, I'll need the help of you people." In the back of my head, the wheels are turning again, saying, "Yeah, a little bit of help maybe, but I think I got this thing down. All I need to do is fill in a couple of gaps. I'll have this 12 steps, 12 days, I'll be done. Sainthood, here I come." So I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started in on me. "Well, there's a few things you ought to do." "Like what?" "Don't drink and go to meetings." "Well, you don't understand. See, I got a coaching job, you know, and it's kind of important for me to get back into the field because I feel that I could become the next Bobby Knight. probably not in coaching prowess, but in technical fouls, I was fast catching up to him." And I said, "You know, I have practice and games and this and that." He said, "Well, go to a meeting every time you get a chance and let me know how it's working out." He said, "Call me." I said, "All right, I'll do that." He said, "Okay, so you don't drink and you go to meetings." I said, "I'll go every time I have a chance." And for some strange reason, I did. The thought never crossed my mind of, I don't know, it was kind of, I liked them people. They were nice to me. They asked me to come back. Nobody else in my life was doing that. So he said, "Next thing I want you to do is get a sponsor." So I started conducting interviews. First, there was a college professor. I figured, being intellectual myself, I needed someone that I could sit down and have deep intellectual discussions with. And, you know, so I'd call this guy up and I'd say, and how did you do the steps? Did you use the 12 and 12 or did you use the big book? And, you know, I mean, how should I go about this thing? And yeah, he was very kind to me. And then there was a guy that came to a meeting and said, I'm rich and I'm an alcoholic. I said, there's my sponsor, just in case I need a little financial backing in some of my ventures. I found out that it was his name, not his financial situation, so his name went off the list. I eventually got my first sponsor because I watched him. He appeared relatively calm. I was not. So I followed him around to a few meetings, and I watched him handle situations that, for me, were testy. Somebody questioned him on one of the things he said. Instead of reaching across and choking the guy like I would have done, because I was in a very different spiritual state than he was, he calmly explained that that's, you know, was how he felt, and this was his experience, and God loved the other guy. And I said, I got to find out what it is that's wrong with this guy. So I decided to bring a little joy to his life, so I asked him to be my sponsor. He said, yes, certainly, no problem. He said, there's two things I want you to do. I said, okay. He said, call me every day. Now, I didn't know that was a suggestion. I thought that was, you know, pretty much a directive, and I figured, you know, if this thing's going to fail, I don't want them to be able to say, it's failed because you didn't do what I told you to do. So I started calling him. And the second thing, he said, come over to my house on Tuesday and tell me your story. So I said, I'll gladly do that, but I don't know where you live. He said, here's the address, and you know how to get there. So I went to his house on Tuesday. It took me about 4 minutes to explain my tale of woe. And I started calling him every day, and I wonder if he knows how much I did for his sobriety and appreciates me the way I feel. Every day I'd call him up and something would be wrong. I'd say, oh, I'm afraid the wife is going to leave me, or I'm afraid the wife isn't going to leave me, depending upon the day of the week. So I can remember calling him one time and I'm saying, I've had it. So what do you mean you've had it? I said, the wife. You know what she did today? And I forget what it was, right or wrong. And he said, okay, what I want you to do is, he said, I want you to apologize to her. And I went ballistic. Apologize to her? Why should I apologize to her? I'm not the one. She's the one that did. She did this, this, and this. And I, you know, well, did you say what you just? Well, of course I did. I had to straighten her out. But I thought, he said, go apologize to her. I said, okay. I'll apologize to her. He said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, you know, as soon as I hang up. He said, no, put the phone down, go apologize to her, come back, tell me how it felt. I was appalled. I said to him, you don't trust me, do you? He said, no, put the phone down, go tell her. And so I learned a couple of very valuable things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that I needed to learn how to trust. I needed to learn a lot of things. But I was so just antsy because I was without a drink. And it's the longest I'd been out of without a drink for a long time. And I didn't understand anything about the disease of alcoholism. So my friend from Maine who brought me to my first meeting, he used to, I don't know how we did it. It's about a 4.5-5-hour trip from his house to mine. But he'd get a little nutsy. He'd come drive to my house and say, oh, I needed to get away. I had to come to a safe place. This is an AA. We were an AA airport because we had the bumper stickers all over the house, you know, on the wall. Real AA members. Of course, my daughter would come in and she'd be embarrassed and she'd take them all down and hide them. And then my wife would go back around, dutifully put them back up. So we were. But he'd get nuts and he'd say, okay, well, I need to talk to my sponsor. He said, yeah, so what are we going to do? He said, we'll go back to Maine. So we jump in the car and drive another 5 hours back to Maine. His sponsor was very important in my sobriety. He really, truly had what I wanted. And we'd go to his house, and I at the time was still trying to work in the bars. My wife was finding her way to AA, and, well, I promised I wouldn't tell this story, but, you know, we did the dutiful thing. I went to AA, she went to Al-Anon. I think we made a mistake there. I should have gone the other way because Al-Anon was where I belonged. You see, you get the 12 steps, and you can drink. She went to learn compassion for the alcoholic. She learned something else, so she soon joined us in our journey. So we're on our way back to Maine to talk to his sponsor because she was working as a waitress in the bar. And I'd go and I'd say, well, gee, you know, I got to pick my wife up for work. So you shouldn't be going into bars. I'd say, well, why should I listen to you? And he'd say, well, we'll go talk to my sponsor. That's why we went, we said to his sponsor, lived in this little, nice little home, and he kind of had a chair in front of the TV that kind of swiveled, and he kind of sat up. He was like royalty. And he put us over there on the couch, and the couch had, the cushions were pretty much gone, and we were both 6 foot something tall. So we're sitting down, our butts are on the floor practically, our knees up in front of us with our hands over our knees, and we're peering over the top getting directions. And he's sitting there, and he said, "No, tell me your story." So he's, my friend says, "I don't go into bars anymore because I fear the alcohol. You don't go into a house of ill repute to listen to the piano player. You don't go here or there. I need to just have completely divorce myself from alcohol." He said, "That's nice. Now, what's your story?" He points to me, and I said, "Well, I need to go into bars." I said, "Because the people there, you know, they were really, really nice to me, and they've offered me a little work, and I get the little part-time thing, and the wife works there, and I got to pick her up. What time does your wife get out of work?" I said, 11 o'clock. He said, "What time do you go to pick her up?" I said, "Oh, about 8. I said, "You don't see anything wrong with that?" I said, "No, you know, she might get out a little early, and it's a good thing that I'm there just in case." Yeah, he says, "It sounds to me like it says in the book something about getting a little vicarious pleasure from the bar." And I was. I can remember another time there was, the boys had decided to go, it was a school thing, and we decided to go have lunch together. And they started drinking, of course, and I'm sitting there. I'm in AA now, and I'm just drinking Coca-Cola. So this friend of mine, every time he had a drink, bought me a Coke. I went to a 5:30 meeting so wired on caffeine that I could hardly sit. 2 o'clock in the morning, I called him up. Said, "Hi, Mac, how are you? I'm not sleeping, are you?" I said, "Yes, I am," click. Didn't bother him at all. But so I need to learn to what to do. So he points to this friend of mine. He says, you go into bars to find out that it's not booze, it's your problem. And he points right at me and he says, you stay out of bars. And that to me was a direction. And I, who the heck am I going to listen? And then, so I started getting the rebellious thing going. And they used to tell me things like, two things. One, when you drink, and you're going to drink again if you keep behaving this way, don't ever say that AA didn't work, because you're not trying it. And if you do drink, remember, booze will bring you back to us, if you're lucky. So they scared me a little bit. So I started to hang around, and I started to feel a little bit better, and then I asked the big question. This guy, I mean, they go to meetings, and they sounded good, you know? They sound like they knew what they were talking about, and they were calm. And so I asked him one day, I said, "What do I got to do to sound like you at meetings? What do I got to do to sound good?" He said, "You want to sound good at meetings? There's 3 things you got to know." He said, "The first thing is, mention the word booze. Booze is an impact word. Gets their attention every time. It's booze. You know, don't say alcohol, drink, say booze. Good impact word." He said, the second thing you want to do is disease. Alcoholism is a disease. You mention the disease, and then everyone knows, and you know what you're talking about. And he said, the third thing you want to do is read, you know, quote something from the big book. It impresses people every time. So I went home feeling, oh, I'll be all set now. And I learned 3 things. Exactly what he wanted me to learn. My problem is booze. And alcoholism is a disease, and I got it. And the answer for me is in the big book. And I only had tried that little experiment a couple of times. I only had to try that experiment a couple of times before I realized that it wasn't about me sounding good. It was about me learning what I'm supposed to learn. And it took me a long time to accept the disease of alcoholism. I'm trying to work the 3rd and the 4th step. I'm going to my sponsor and saying, "Here's my 4th step." "Okay." And he'd read down through this crap I'd written. He'd say, "Now we know all the reasons you drank. Why don't you just relax? Because you don't work the first 2. It happens. You know, it says something in the literature about the action step starts with 3. The other 2 we engaged only in reflection." I had to sit back and take an honest look at what and who I was. And when I came to that conclusion, I was damn glad I was in AA. Because when the realization hit, when I finally found the God, the G-O-D of my understanding, and got my gift of desperation, it was because a group of drunks gave me some good orderly direction to get where I needed to go. And those people probably saved my life. They got me involved in the steps. I can remember I went and did my 4th and 5th step with this guy. The next day, they asked me the most important question I think I've been asked since. It was the day I did my 5th. I went back to the place. I did my 6th and 7th. The next morning I got up and I was feeling pretty good. You know, I really realized who I was, and I was okay with that. And he says to me, "Well, are you one of us?" And I answered yes, and I knew I was telling the truth because I understood it for the first time. I was an alcoholic. I got this thing, you know, and I hang around with people just like me so that I can get better. I learned about trust because I began to trust those people. Then they suggested I get involved in that dirty word, service. My first sponsor said, your home group, your group over there in Fairhaven is looking for a GSR. Why don't you volunteer? I said, GSR, how do you spell that? I said, you'll figure that out later. He just said, go volunteer. So I went and I said, hi, I understand you're looking for a GSR. And they said, yeah, we just voted one in last week. Dick, right over there, he's our new GSR. I said, oh, okay. Dick stood up and said, I didn't want to do the damn thing anyway. Go ahead, you can be it. Swept in unanimously. It was marvelous. A couple things I learned about service. I got the alcoholic ego that recovers very, very, very fast. I start to feel good and I'm in trouble getting drunk again. So service was good for me because I found out that when you go and do service, you know, you think that it's because they're sweeping you into office, and then you go back to give the report, and you find out they really don't care. So it's about holding this thing together. So it taught me a bit of humility. So I tried the GSR thing. I tried the DCM thing. I was running. I was alternate DCM, and I was doing a heck of a job, mind you. And I stood for DCM, and they voted some guy in over me that had 9 months. Now, I was crushed, humiliated. I decided I was never going to go back to that service thing, but for some strange reason, they had to have some dumb job done, so I went and did it, and I learned a lot from that. I learned that it's not about me, and yet it is all about me. This is a selfish, self-centered disease. The first thing I was told to read was about selfishness and self-centeredness on page 62 of the Big Book. Of course, it didn't apply to me then. There are some days I probably don't think it applies to me now, but that same self-delusion will get me today. Alcoholism is a disease. It is cunning, baffling, and powerful. My sponsor adds patient and persistent, and I add a couple of D's. One of them is it's delusional, and the other one is that it makes decisions for me that I don't need to be making on my own. And I needed a lot of help, and I still do because it's still trying to get me today. I got involved in service. I don't know why. There were those business meetings, and I'd leave them every time saying I'm never going back there. Those people don't know what they're talking about. All they do is fight. And it's the secret. There's buttons that go around that say service is the secret. And if you're not involved in service, then someday I hope you find out how it completes the circle. I had to learn something about working the 12 steps. I went and I did a fourth and fifth step with this guy. Later on, he guided me into some service positions, and then I got a new service position, and I said, gee, I had to call him up and ask him his opinion, his advice. We had met for dinner a few months before, had a wonderful time, and I kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. And every Thursday night, I'd go to my Big Book meeting, and every Thursday night, we'd read something that he had told me. I think I thought he was coming up with this stuff on his own. And I would swear, oh, God, when I get home, I'm going to give him a call, see how he's doing, you know. And I said, oh, gee, I got this new service position, and I know that if I say I got this new service position, he's going to think I'm bragging. So, and I put it off, and I put it off for a long time, months and months and months. And one day I finally called up, and I said, hi, Herman, this is Mike. I just wanted to call and tell you I was at my meeting tonight, and we read something else that you told me. I want to thank you for all you've done for me, the great help that you've given me. Wanted to chat with you for a while. Left the message on his machine. The next day I got a phone call from his wife saying, wish you'd call me, we need to talk. I said, something's up. So I called her back and she said, it's strange that you called when you called, because it was the day of his funeral. And she said, I needed to hear from someone what of some of the great things that he did to help other people. And she said, your phone call was a lifesaver. And we had a long, wonderful conversation about how that man had touched a lot of lives. So, and I still think that he's watching out today, so I still walk on eggshells on occasion because I think God might put him in charge of the lightning bolts. Because those are the two things I was afraid of. I was afraid that God was going to find out who I am and I'm going to get a lightning bolt in the back of the head, or I was going to have to shave my head and sell Big Books in airports. That hasn't happened yet. I got involved in this service thing begrudgingly. I was an area chair. I've been on several different committees. I became a delegate. I've been a trustee. And I thank God for every one of those experiences. But I'll tell you the secret now. The secret is what you found, some of you found in the 12 steps, because the greatest promise in this program is there. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That means if you do the steps, it's guaranteed you will have a spiritual awakening. But then it goes on to say, we tried to carry this message to the next suffering alcoholic. Tried to carry this message. You see, the spiritual awakening doesn't reach fruition or doesn't come full circle unless I try to pass it on. I found out what those people were talking to me about in the fourth and fifth step when I passed it on to people in their fourth and fifth step. And I get to relive the experience of my first surrender every time I try to help somebody else. In my program, in my relationship with God, in my spirituality, in my feeling and gratitude for AA grows every time I do that. So if I sit on my haunches and don't do anything, I might even be able to stay sober, although I doubt it today, because my disease has learned everything I learned, and it's ready to use it against me, like it always did. Seemed like a good idea at the time. No matter how much I learned, how much stuff was in the back of my head, I need help in from recovering from alcoholism today. The same thing is true of my service. The first tradition talks about our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery, that means my recovery, depends upon AA unity. Now, like it or not, I'm still selfish, and my recovery today is the most important thing. And that means I got to get along with you, then damn well I'm going to get along with you, because that's the way it works for me. Little by little by little, we come to some agreement, and I've seen arguments, and I've seen things discussed, and I've seen arguments on the conference floor over the most picky and little things that I could ever come up with. I served on a committee. I learned about trust because I arrived at the conference for the first time on report and charter committee, and I said, yeah, but what about those guys on literature? How do I know they're doing the job? They said, you just focus on your committee and you trust the committee system. And when we got to the conference and we presented our stuff, they wanted to change one word in one of our recommendations. They argued about it for an hour and a half. I said, I've had enough. Change the damn word. Let's get on with it. They said, well, we'll have the committee caucus in the front while we're on break, and they'll tell us what they're going to do. Wink, wink. We want you to change your word. So we went over and we sat in the corner. I said, I'm ready to change. I've heard enough. And my conference buddy, a dear friend of mine, turned to me and he said, do you remember what we did in the committee room? I said, yeah. He said, remember the discussions we had? Yeah. He said, remember the questions we asked? Yeah. Have they asked any question that we didn't ask in that room? I said, no, we were well prepared. He said, then why should we change our recommendation? This is what we agreed upon. This is what we prayed about. This is what we came up with. I say we go with it. And we went with it. And we went back and we said, we're not changing a thing. You want to change it, it's up to you. This is our recommendation. And they said, okay, passed it, and they were gone. So... But I learned about trusting in other people, and when those committees came up, I learned the respect for the fact that I knew they had sat in rooms and done the same thing. I didn't need to be in that room. You know, when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. Well, I got some bad news for you. Somewhere between where you're living and where I'm living, tonight there's going to be somebody at meeting that needs help, and none of us are going to be there to help them. I don't know how they're ever going to get sober, but how do I know that the hand of AA is going to be there? Because I got involved in service and I know what those people are talking about, and I began to trust in the process of AA. And it helped my sobriety. I found there are 36 spiritual principles that I can base my life on. There are 12 steps that I use in my personal life. There are 12 traditions that I'm trying to use in my personal life to get along with my wife and others. And then there are 12 concepts that I learn about working in the service. And there are some real neat suggestions in there about not being punitive, about not saying the things I want to say just to be mean, spirited, about keeping my mouth shut when I ought to keep my mouth shut, just to stir the pot one more time, about being disagreeable just to be disagreeable so that I get some attention. But I needed to learn a lot of things, and I learned it all in Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I know I met and married the love of my life. I didn't know that when I married her. I found that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my kids today. I knew that, but I didn't really know that. I didn't know what it was like to be a parent, but I watched my kids. I watched my daughter with her twins, and somewhere along the line, she picked up some good stuff, probably from her mother. My son, I watch him with his little girls. He does a marvelous job. And I ask myself, where did they get this stuff? Alcoholics Anonymous. First time I got, well, I got a sponsor now, that kindly old gentleman, and he'd call the house and he'd say, Mike there? Yep. Is that you, Jamie? Yep. He said, I'm Bill. I'm your sponsor. Let me get... He helped my kids grow up. He told them things about what was going on with me. They've come a long way. And I want AA to be for them and those grandkids, because that's important to me, that this thing goes on and lives. I learned recently that someone in a meeting was reading the 12 traditions, and they made one of those Freudian slips. It says, our service centers may employ special workers. And this person read, our service centers may enjoy special workers. That's not what I'd been doing. I had been taking those people to task. I had been focusing on the negative that some of those people had done that didn't just sit well with me. And they didn't do it because they were trying to get away with something. They did it because they thought it was the right thing. So I stopped employing them and I started enjoying them. And I started going to the people who I knew were doing marvelous work, and I told them they were doing marvelous work, and I told them they were special to me. And my life's been getting better ever since. I have a couple of people that actually speak to me on occasion, so I would be remiss if I didn't quote another New Englander who probably had a little alcoholism running in his family, if I didn't say, ask not what AA can do for you, ask what you can do for AA. Don't ask what you can do for another newcomer, ask what the newcomer can do for you. Because my sobriety is enhanced every time I help somebody else. My sobriety is enhanced every time I get involved in service work, because when I'm doing the drudgery of those little jobs that nobody else wants to do, it helps me inside. It helps my spirit become better. Because the spirit is inside of me is the same one that's inside of you. And some days, we all know the song that spirit sings, and some days I forget, and I need you to sing that song to me so I remember why I'm here and what I'm here for. So when I was 12 or 13 years old, I was involved in a religious ceremony. Okay, it wasn't an exorcism, I know what you're thinking, but I was a kid. My parents were religious. They said, go do this thing. And I remember the bishop, he gave this wonderful talk, and he said something at the end, and it never made sense to me till I got here. In the last few years, it makes perfect sense to me. And he said, don't go to heaven alone. Take someone with you. That, to me, is what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. They talk about a fourth dimension of existence. They talk about a heaven. Don't go alone. Take someone with you. And you can take a lot of people with you if you will get involved in service, because you know, I'm not going to be able to help every one of them individually, and I'm not very good at it. But I know that if I'll help pick up the coffee cups at my sponsor's meeting, I'll let him work the room. He's good at it. I'll make a cake for an anniversary. I'll make sure that literature is provided. I will get involved in this thing because I want AA to be there. AA is self-correcting, but it's not self-correcting if we don't get involved. We own this thing. Bill and Bob aren't with us anymore. They gave it to us. They said, take care of it. This is our legacy. It's ours to take care of or to lose. Now, there's a lot of talk about back to basics. It's the theme of a lot of conventions, conferences, groups, books. When I heard back to basics, I went back to my basics, which is 1985. I came to AA, and there was a lot of stuff being talked about in the rooms. And it didn't make any sense to me then, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me now. I had to go a little further back and look at the history of where these people came from. When they said back to basics, it's a really simple message. If you got a problem with booze, we got an answer for you. And I don't care if you're an ANDA or a this, that, or the other thing. Are you an alcoholic? Because if you're an alcoholic, then I'm one of your kind. And if you're not partially alcoholic, you're probably a pure alcoholic, just like I am. We're all pure alcoholics. We've got two things in common. One is a disease. The other is a program to help us survive so that we don't have to die from it. I want to thank you for all your things. A dear friend of mine told me, he says, he said, you're going to have a great time in Minnesota. Those people are really, really, really very nice. I'll let you know tomorrow. He said, you're going to have a great time. It's one of the greatest things ever going. He said, but remember two things. What's that? He says, one, it's your job to speak, and it's their job to listen. He said, for God's sake, make sure you finish before they do. So I thank you very much.